Good morning. We are gathering. It's a little bit after 9, so we're running a little bit behind schedule already, but we have a packed morning, so we're going to get started in just a few minutes if you want to get settled in when Sue gets back, which is now. We and Jean. Okay, we're ready to get started. And you are, Sue, first on the agenda to preview.
Actually, this is a recap of I'm just going to do a very brief recap of tomorrow, or of tomorrow, of yesterday. Well, tomorrow, I'll tell you what I'm doing tomorrow. and for those of you, do we have anybody on the phone? Do we know? Great. Welcome to you on the phone. We're going to briefly recap our discussion yesterday that began with a discussion on what is the authentic patient representative in engagement in research. And we discussed, I think at the end of our discussion, we really addressed some overarching considerations important to this group that included that either the patient or the patient organization that is representing the patient in research, that they are a representative of the condition, illness, or situation that is being studied, and that we raised a concern if a patient is wearing two hats, and we decided that it was important to not have a patient representative that is playing another role other than patient. And we also shared that it was important that conflicts of interest were that they're transparent and considered. And so I think that those were the main issues that came up yesterday. And we also discussed the opportunity to, instead of creating a document or definitions, that we would look at the programs that we have created at PCORI, including the rubric, including using the engagement officers in their work with directly with the projects, as well as what we do in our applications to identify the profiles that we want. So we're going to first, in PCORI, look at the programs that we have created and see how do we embed this message effectively to ensure that the patient representation, that those considerations are well considered when looking at the patient population. After that, we reviewed, Susan Hildebrand and Greg shared how PCORI is partnering and engaging with the other stakeholders who are important in research. And they went through the various buckets of other stakeholders and shared that actually the number and the remarkable outreach that they have done to their various stakeholders. After that, we came back to talking about, again, the patient representativeness in research. And then we concluded with, I thought was a really enlightening and confirming, I think, for all of us, presentation on the data that our evaluations team is collecting from our funded projects that shows levels of engagement and respondents regarding engagement that's going to help build the PCORI story. And I think we all thought it was the levels of engagement that is preliminary, but we think it's very promising, and we look forward to seeing additional data at our next PEEP where it really pulls apart our patient engagement data from the other stakeholders to give us a better perspective on that. That particular discussion concluded with an evaluation of the rubric, which this particular group helped create. And, again, we found that it was overall very helpful to the applicants and the reviewers as a tool. So that was basically yesterday's discussion. Anything that Chair and Co-Chair you would like to add to the recap or Jean? No. Okay. So Thank you. That was, it was a good day. And I like to sit back and look at how all of the different sessions that we discussed yesterday are interlinked and interwoven. And I think the discussion today will continue some of that, especially as we talk about the compensation framework and some of our programs. So you can see the lineup for today. We'll talk about the Ambassador Program first, and then the Pipeline to Proposal Awards, just an update. Then we'll have a break. We're going to talk about the compensation framework, and then we'll conclude with privacy data and safety monitoring boards and IRBs, or Institutional Review Board discussion. Before we start off on this, I do want to introduce and let you know we've been talking a lot about our engagement officers, and I know it's not a new concept to you, but PCORI is, I think, really, really appreciating the input and the potential that engagement officers will bring to PCORI, and we identify that we're really creating a new profession within a research organization, and you have not had the opportunity to meet our new engagement officer, Michelle Felice, and that she is working. Michelle joined us November, and so she's jumped right into the Improving Healthcare Systems program. And I'll ask Rachel if you could circulate Michelle's bio so you can get to know a little bit about her background. And I also want to share that we have, with Jean's help, we have received approval to hire a fourth engagement officer. And so we are actually, I just realized I have, we are actively receiving resumes and applications. So it's exciting to see this take off at PCORI. At this time, I'd like to invite our presenters for the Ambassador Program. I think Suzanne and Anya will be presenting. I don't know if Rashonda's going to add anything. But Anya, Suzanne, do you want to kick it off?
Sure. Yeah, good morning. And Anya and Rashonda are both going to, we're going to sort of tag team this, but I wanted to give some introductory remarks because I was really struck yesterday by how much our conversation in the morning really teed up what we're going to share with you today about the ambassadors. We talked a lot about we need to dig deeper, we need to keep expanding our pool of eligible patient partners, and I think the Ambassadors Program is one great opportunity to do that. We really have spent a lot of time, as you know, because we've asked you for a lot of input over the past year, thinking, strategizing, making plans to really grow this and make it very meaningful in a bidirectional way. From PCORI's standpoint, we really need a large pool of skilled and ready people to sort of tap into for the work we're doing, but then we also want to add value to those members of the program, and so we've been thinking a lot about sort of this bidirectional concept and how we can make the program really strong, and so instead of coming to you asking for more input, we feel like we're at a place now where we can actually do our ta-da moment and show you what we're planning to do, and I think we're all very excited about the next steps. So I'm going to turn it over to Anya to get us kicked off.
Great. Thanks, Suze. So during this presentation, we have just two objectives, and the first one is just to provide you with a program update. I think that it's always best for you all to know where we are as far as the numbers, and then give you some great information on how we have strategies for the future and what our action plan will be in the coming months. So currently, we have, and it's probably over 100 now, but we have 99 individuals who have, you know, completed the ambassador's training and can wear that title of an ambassador. 82 of them are individuals, and we have 17 organizational ambassadors. And at this point, the program has kind of started to do what we thought it would do, where we're having more patient consumers and also patient advocacy groups join in. In the beginning, we had, you know, mostly researchers that were interested in the program. And by region, we are still, you know, starting to space out good. We can use more recruitment on the West, and I think that in the coming months, we'll definitely look at our funding portfolio and any sort of gaps that we have, whether it's statewide or region, to increase recruitment from those areas. And then I don't know if we're, oh, and then as far as ethnicity, we've seen some increase in the Latino and African-American communities, but definitely this slide is definitely something that we want to continue to make more diverse and our pool, because that would really help in a lot of our fundings going forward. And here is just a list of the 17 organizational ambassadors. We have two representatives from the Dia de la Mujer Latina program, and that's with Venus Jens, who's a member of the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel. And she just felt that it was very beneficial to have two members, so we're gracious of that. And in one of the following slides, we talked a lot during our strategic planning meetings of really having distinct definitions and roles for individual and organizational ambassadors. And so on this slide, we attempted to just come up with a clear definition so the individuals would not be confused. A lot of times when people submit their interest form, they say, you know, is it best for me to be an organizational ambassador or an individual? And so we hope that this would help guide people in knowing where best to fit their expertise going forward. And all ambassadors, no matter where you come in, we request that you accept PCORI's engagement principles of reciprocal relationships, partnerships, co-learning, trust, transparency, and honesty. And we think that no matter your role in the program, accepting those is greatly appreciated. And so for our strategies for the future, and these three buckets is something that we discussed during our last PEAT meeting. We broke out into sessions, and so we wanted to continue that energy from that going forward into our various strategy meetings that we've had since then in-house. And so areas for growth, adding value, and opportunities for cross-fertilization is really where we're going in the next coming months. And so we have a slide dedicated to each one of the green bullets underneath, and I'll cover the areas for growth. And so our first area is really aligning with science priorities. And while we continue to work very closely with science, we realize, too, that we can do some things within engagement, whereas we're looking at our attendance from our regional events and any sort of other advocacy groups that we've had some sort of contact with in the past, that we can bring them into the loop and really share the benefits of the program. So we'll continue to work with science while also moving forward in-house within our own programs to see where we can increase numbers in that area. And we continue to connect ambassadors to science opportunities such as work groups. We get calls all the time of sort of matching patients to different advisory opportunities even outside of PCORI. And so these getting more of those would really help bring momentum to the program and really show more value in the activities of the ambassadors. And so as our science teams give us funding opportunities that are coming out the door, we can really get together and say, hey, are there any ambassadors who are interested in this topic? Do you have any sort of skill sets that we can match, even possibly serving as a reviewer? And so we'll just always circle back and use the ambassadors as a great resource for moving any sort of agendas forward within PCORI. And also we realize that an area of growth would be our funded projects. You know, they're out there doing the work, and so they would be great individuals to bring forward into the ambassadors program. And so with the new engagement officer's role, we see them as being our ears to those projects and to really promote the ambassadors program during their kickoff calls and interim calls, especially if a lot of times during the calls you have patient partners that are engaged, and maybe at the end of the program they still want to be involved in PCORS. So letting them know that we have this program that's open to them would be helpful. We also plan to loop in our pipeline and engagement awardees. We recently got a request from one of our engagement awardees wanting to do outreach, and we realized, you know, hey, we really need to loop them in as funded projects and let them know that they can also be ambassadors for the program. So plan to do that as well. And this last bullet relates to, you know, anyone who has applied for ambassadors funding. A lot of times, if one has applied, they may have already been in touch with PCORI in some other way. Maybe they've attended a webinar or a work group. And so we just want to let them know that even though they have been unsuccessful in getting funding from PCORI, they can still loop in to the ambassadors program, and that may also help strengthen their future applications that they submit to PCORI. And the last one, which is really important for our organizational involvement, and so we really want to beef up. Now we have 17 organizational ambassadors, but really finding more value and increasing their role, because we realize that they have huge networks and the ability to disseminate information for PCORI. So we want to have them more involved where it comes to social media and marketing of any specific events and initiatives that PCORI has going on. And we also want to hold targeted meetings and events for our organizational ambassadors to get them more involved so they don't feel so detached from the program, because we realize that they bring a breadth of knowledge to the program that we can really take advantage of. And I believe the next one will pass off to Sue.
Great. Thanks, Anya. And I didn't think about slides, but you'll have to advance for me, so thank you. So moving into sort of this, the value proposition, and like I said earlier, there's really a bidirectional element here, because not only is this a value to PCORI, but we want to make this meaningful to the ambassadors. You are all aware of the toolkit that we created, so it's just sort of a constant process to make sure the materials in the toolkit are current. If these folks are out sort of speaking about PCORI and sharing information, we want to make sure they have correct, updated materials. We're also getting into just a much more active calendar. So we're slating different calls and webinars, trying to think creatively about who some compelling guest speakers might be. You know, we're probably not going to get Will Ferrell, but other, you know, exciting medical community speakers that would really draw some interest from our ambassador community and make it a really make you feel like you're part of a select group with these unique opportunities to hear from leaders in the field or from our funded projects who can share information about what it's like to be in the trenches doing this work. We've connected with J.B. Smalley from the PCORI Network to let our ambassadors participate in the grand rounds that they have where they similar to the first bullet, really just opportunities to learn and hear about what's going on in PCORNET. We also want to make sure our ambassadors are very aware of anything we've got going on at PCORI, anything that they can listen in on or attend, but also non-PCORI events. You know, we get invitations and alerts all the time about activities that our ambassadors might be interested in, and we really think of ourselves as a conduit for this information, so we want to make sure we're publicizing to the greatest extent possible. We do have ambassador newsletters, and these are great opportunities to highlight work of our ambassadors, continue the work to connect ambassadors to one another, and that's something that's ongoing. This last one was surveys and crowdsourcing opportunities. This is another really bidirectional opportunity, and this is a great chance for PCORI. We see our this is a treasure trove to us of these people that are connected and committed to PCORI, particularly once we start growing. If we have this very large program that includes our funded projects, other people that are just interested in the work of PCORI, If we have a question, you know, maybe it could be we're going to talk about compensation later. Maybe we could have a Twitter chat or do a quick Survey Monkey and just get a pulse for what are your thoughts on compensation. I mean, what a great resource to be able to have this committed group that's ready to provide information at a moment's notice. And then from their perspective, it's an opportunity to contribute to those dialogues. So we're thinking about how do we tap into this tremendous resource of these committed people. If you can advance, Anya, thank you. And I'm actually going to have Rashonda Welch, our National Urban Fellow, who is working specifically on social media work as it pertains to the Ambassadors Program. I'm going to have Rashonda walk through this slide.
Good morning. All right, so when it comes to social media, one of the things that we wanted to focus on is just making sure that there's an increased level of engagement when it comes to social media, especially because social media is the best outlet for the ambassadors to be able to connect with each other, considering that ambassadors are located all throughout the nation. So one of the things that we wanted to do was to get some advice from current ambassadors, as well as get some information from other organizations who are very successful in building online communities. So I'm in a continual process of researching other organizations just to get information about what they're doing to build their community. And then in addition to that, I've also been conducting some targeted interviews with ambassadors. We have plans to interview 8 ambassadors. So far, 3 have been interviewed. And then from that conversation, not only am I getting information about their perspectives of the program in general, but also just focusing in on their social media use as well. So from those interviews, I've received a few suggestions that I'd like to highlight. One person said that it would be helpful to promote the mobile app version of Yammer. This person feels as if her use of Yammer would increase if she had the opportunity to use the program through her phone. And so that's something that we can start to promote. And then also we had another suggestion to develop a more substantial member profile in Yammer so that ambassadors have an opportunity to know more information about each person and then be able to connect with people using Yammer. All right. We're also in the process of transitioning from Yammer to a platform called Chatter, which is very similar to Yammer. So because of that transition, we have the opportunity to try to customize Chatter. So some of the things that we've done is we've been in conversation with a person and given her some information about what types of trackers we would need in Yammer. Well, what types of trackers that we don't have in Yammer that we feel like would be essential for us to grow the program using Chatter. And so some of those suggestions were to develop badges for the profile, and that's something, it's almost like an identifier that goes along with the photo that's listed in Chatter. And so that would allow ambassadors to connect with other ambassadors just by seeing something very, like a simple badge, just to be able to know that this person participated in a particular activity, or maybe this person has an expertise in a certain area. So that gives them an easier way to connect and build relationships. We will continue to encourage ambassadors to promote the program using their own social networks. We know that ambassadors are connected through programs like LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter as well. So we just want to make sure that they're continuing to just promote the ambassador program and just encourage other people to participate. And this will happen more once the program moves into a public format. And finally, plan and execute more frequent and energized social media activity. So this is something we're continually working on. And in the process, what I've done is created a social media content calendar. So I'm tracking the information that is posted in Yammer, and then I'm also tracking what kind of responses I'm getting. So I'm trying to get a gauge of what kind of information people tend to like more or want to share or have more comments about so that we can continue posting that type of information to build a sense of community and then also to build interest in using the social media platforms. Thank you, Rashonda.
Okay, so the last piece of adding value kind of gets really into the nuts and bolts of what is the true value for people engaged in this work. And we do have with our new training department the opportunity to think about continuing medical education and continuing ed credit for some of our PCORI programs. You see college credit up there, which is a little bit pie in the sky, but this idea actually came from one of our funded projects. There is a project that's involving teenagers that are patient partners on the research team, and in order to get them sort of incentivized, why would I want to do this in my spare time, the project team actually worked with the local high school to get them high school credit through a science class for their participation on the project. So we probably should just say school credit. I apologize. College credit might be a little harder to figure out. But some sort of incentive like that that makes it real and something you can put on a resume and really benefit from, which we think would be really, really great. Then there's just, this is the obvious one. It's just connection to PCORI community and research partnership opportunities. We probably field, I can't even count how many phone calls or emails every week, just seeking, do you know anyone doing XYZ? How would I get in touch with them? And we think of the ambassadors as this great platform that we don't have to do a whole lot of care and feeding of. Once you put people in, you heard from Rashonda about different badges and flags you can put on profiles. People can self-facilitate. They could connect with one another, and that's one of the true values here. And then the recognition bullet is really about how do we sort of identify, you know, really high performers, people who are doing great work. We've got a couple different avenues for that. We've got the newsletter. We feature different people, and we'll continue to think about new and different ways to recognize great participants to the program. So you go to the next slide. Oops. Okay. So opportunities for cross-fertilization. And this will sort of kind of pull all the pieces together that we've just talked about. So we're talking about growth, but we also want to think back to what already exists at PCORI and how we tie the ambassadors into all of our activities. I think Anya mentioned if we've got folks that are particularly skilled in one content area and we have a merit review need in that content area, that's a great place to sort of harvest merit reviewers from. If we look at working groups, funded project activities, advisory panel recruitment, et cetera, there's always something going on at PCORI, and we are constantly looking for activated, ready patient partners or other stakeholder partners to participate in this work. The pipeline to proposal application review, and this could just be one of many similar activities where, again, we need to pull from this pool. And as you talked about yesterday, you can get in the habit of going back to the same people over and over again, and we really want to diversify and expand that group that we keep tapping into. And certainly, as we are working on this critically important dissemination and implementation framework and thinking forward to disseminating and sharing the results from our funded work, the ambassadors is a logical place to look for a ready-made infrastructure. These are people with great networks. If we can sort of build these bridges now when we have results ready to share, I mean, that's a great platform for sharing that information. So facilitating connections and active collaboration between all of these initiatives, kind of, and Sue and I have talked a lot about, I know there's a graphic that would capture this. I haven't been able to draw it. I've tried several times. But the ambassadors are sort of in the middle, and all of these activities are swirling around it, and I'm trying to figure out how I make that visually. Someday I will produce a graphic. But then serve as the platform for shared learning and dialogue between diagnostic, population, or other affinity groups. We just see so much promise by pulling people all into this common platform. And then the next slide. This is kind of looking outside the ambassadors program, so looking at patient family advisory councils, the IHI, the FDA, NQF, CMS, ARC, all of the acronyms that we know and love, thinking about what efforts are going on across these other organizations, what important work could we tap into, and how can the ambassadors be connected to that work. We've actually pulled from the ambassador program to staff some technical advisory or technical expert panels, and we've had other requests to sort of peer into our ambassador program. What are you guys doing in there? How could we replicate something like that? Who do you have in the program that we might be able to borrow or employ in our purposes? So we're seeing a lot of opportunities externally as well. And then Rashonda shared, she's really looking at other programs, even outside of the healthcare space, to think about who has built really successful, engaged, active communities, whether on social media or or otherwise, and how can we learn from them? So that's sort of a snapshot into all of the work that we've got going on. But suffice it to say, we're at a great place right now. We've done a lot of strategic thinking. We've talked to really everyone on staff at PCORI to get some good ideas about how we can make this work, and I think we're looking forward to the future. So we can stand for questions if you have any or have discussion.
I have a question about how, maybe I missed this, but in terms of vetting the ambassadors, do we reject anybody?
Do you want me to field, Anya? There is a training module that you technically are not an ambassador until you've gone through the training, and that's how you officially become one. This is something we really thought a lot about at the beginning. There was some concern about what if you get someone in the program that is doing some things that aren't above board or we're not excited about the activity. And so far that has not happened. We have not had to vote anyone off the island, as Sue says. And I think we've got mechanisms in place where we could kind of deal with that on an ad hoc basis. But in general, because of the training, because of the nature of the program, you're going to learn about what we're looking for, kind of the activity and the manner of respect and discourse we would expect from you as an ambassador. And so far, it just hasn't been a problem. I don't know if Sue or Jean want to add more, but we're not naive. We know that could arise, but it hasn't happened yet.
And to date, Saul, we've the invitation to those to become an ambassador, so we kind of have two filters, that they have been involved in PCORI to some degree. So right now it is not open to the public. So we haven't not invited anybody who's applied because they've already gone through either an advisory panel or a merit review or a workshop. So they already are kind of embracing the promise of PCORI and then going through a second filter of doing the education and the training. So it's when we as an organization decide when and if we're going to open up to the public, do we have additional layers that we want to consider to assure that we have a pool of ambassadors that embrace our principles.
I just think it's a potential area of vulnerability being attuned to that.
Yep. So this is actually very helpful. I know in the past when I've sort of put this ambassador program out to PCORI's members, you know, a lot of patients and patient organizations, I think, they have so many things going on that they haven't seen the relevance of it. They don't understand what am I going to get out of this and what am I supposed to do with it. So this is actually very helpful. I think in terms of moving forward, I would just ask the question of how are you going to sort of market this to the patient group so that they understand this value. And I think in terms of expressing the value, one of the things that I saw in this presentation that I would define as probably giving them value is this idea of aligning the groups around your priorities. I mean, and when I say priorities, I mean your real priorities, like, you know, so you have a cancer group, an epilepsy group, but the things that that patients and patient groups actually connect to, you know, a little bit more targeted than the broader national priorities. I do think that as you think about, especially with the organizational members, that idea of being able to use the ambassador program to connect to like-minded organizations and individuals could be a real asset. So I just would recommend that throughout your portfolio, and I know I've said this a million times, but, you know, when you do kind of create those, you know, here are all the projects we're doing in all of these different areas so that patients and patient groups can better connect to that, it will help you not only with enrollment and the ambassador program, but also I think help the organizations and the individuals to connect with the research you're doing and in the dissemination program. As I understand, Mathematica is going to be promoting this idea of having dissemination advisory subgroups are also aligned around those topics. And those could be consistent throughout PCORI, which would just take some of the mystery out of it. Thank you.
Sarah, could I just make a quick comment in that? I think I said yesterday that we're going to host a roundtable in March targeted to patient organizations, specific,
specifically, and we're going to do a series of them, we think, but to really reach out to those organizations that have memberships and affiliates all over the United States, and we want to talk about this, you know, them becoming an organizational ambassador, and what are the incentives, and how do we collaborate with them and demonstrate to them and their members that there is a benefit to becoming a member or an ambassador. So we're thinking strategically, how do we engage the national patient organizations as ambassadors, and then really develop some incentives and some, like it's like Suzanne said, some bi-directional opportunities, especially around our targeted, our future targeted areas, but also what we have funded, there are some dissemination opportunities as well. So we want to look at both sides of that.
Where are y'all, though, in the process of actually making more apparent to a consumer or a patient that's coming onto the if I wanted to know everything PCORI's doing in the area of, and I'm just using this as an example, epilepsy. Right. I mean, are y'all working on making that easier to access for folks? I mean, I know we've said that's been talked about for a long time. It just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, like many new organizations, IT infrastructure is a real issue. So we have a pretty large effort going on right now to categorize and classify all the different projects we're doing. And creating a back-end database that's much more sophisticated than PCORI developed when it was first established. So we're able now to actually pull up, because of this classification, all the projects we're doing, let's say, on epilepsy or, you know, cardiovascular disease and slice it smaller. What we're working on is to make that easy for the public to do from a back-end database. And it's just, you know, the fact of the matter that small organizations often make IT decisions that haunt them when they grow.
Yeah, I mean, I just, providing a patient organization with the ability to put a link on their website that click here to see everything PCORI's doing on X, you know, would just be a phenomenal benefit.
And I think that, excuse me, one of the goals is to be able to have those buttons that link directly back to PCORI's website.
I'm a PCORI ambassador, and the switch from Yammer to Chatter, I haven't found there's a lot of engagement by anyone other than staff sort of pushing information out, but maybe I'm not in the right spots on, you're on Yammer now. We have Chatter at work. So, and the same, this exact same thing happens. It's like three people use it. And I'm just wondering if that's, you know, if you feel like there's enough value there that it's the platform that's the problem and not maybe the way it's organized. And kind of one of the principles of engagement that I hear over and over is meet people where they are, and whether you've considered like a Facebook group or a LinkedIn group where people may already be and easier to push out to their network, because now you have to visit those sites and then bring it back, and it's just one more step in crowded, busy lives that prevents, I think, any traction. So there's that question, and then I also had another question that just escaped me. So I'll
tackle the social media question while you're thinking of the second question. We've had a lot of conversations with our communications folks. We've talked about if Facebook or LinkedIn or one of the other platforms could be the place to go. One of the concerns was switching again, sort of that you lose people every time you make a transition. But it is something we're still actively talking about. I think it's probably still up for discussion. There's pros and cons to either direction. Part of Rashonda's work is to really figure out, no matter what the platform, how do you increase activity? So I think it is an important piece. We also, social media is critically important, but there's other
avenues to connect as well. So we're really being pretty holistic in how we think about engagement and meeting people where they are. So I appreciate that insight.
The second part was about credentialing and the idea of credits for those who need CMEs. And, you know, school credit is great, but some of us don't. But maybe there's something we'd like to, you know, work toward in terms of continuing education that just keeps us up to date on what the principles are and that kind of thing. So I don't know if there's an idea for
Yeah, definitely. We've talked about some sort of certification and what that looks like. And because it really, we have such a, which is a great problem to have, we have such a mixture of people and what their needs would be that we need to sort of appeal to each category of folks. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities for varied types of recognition or credentialing or certification. And so that's, again, an active conversation, and I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
I think I'm an ambassador, but I'm not sure. But I'm technologically challenged because I had difficulty getting through the training course. And I hit the wrong button. My fingers don't always hit the right button. And then I couldn't get it to come back. So I almost gave up. But I did talk to the staff, and they said that I was an ambassador, and they sent me a certificate and everything. But I don't recognize any of the wonderful activities that you've described. I haven't seen any of them. I think as part of being an authentic patient, I think we need continually to be fed information. And I don't necessarily go looking for new information. I don't know what's there. So help me.
Well, Perry, thank you, and I'm happy that you did not give up and you have your certificate. And I think that as the program beefs up in the coming months, you'll see, like, we're planning at the end of the month to have a conference call with all ambassadors just to provide you an update on changes within the program. And then the next month we'll have a featured pipeline to proposal awardee who can give us some information on how, like, an individual like yourself might want to apply for pipeline, and they can share their experiences. So we also send out emails in addition to, like, not just focusing on Yammer. So, you know, I guess maybe you and I, we can talk, and maybe I can, you know, do a better job of providing you with more information of activities that come up to date. But a lot of times for, like, the TEP opportunity, we try not to reach out to the same individuals too much, because a lot of times people go on our website and they'll see who ambassadors are and say, oh, I want that person and that person and that person. So we know that all of you are very busy, but we'll continue to do a better job with reaching out to you.
Just a couple observations. So, you know, as I understand the ambassador program, initially it was to really sort of spread the word about the CORI. And what I heard today was a little bit, as you're talking about plans for the future, some of that I think continues. But I also heard some of it being more sort of inward facing, you know, like being a merit reviewer. And so I just think that that requires some perhaps rethinking about who these ambassadors are, what their roles are, and certainly in a description of what an ambassador does. So that's the first comment. One of the things that's a future activity that is more outward-facing is the work around D&I, so disseminating findings and work that's being done by the CORI, and I think that that's a really nice opportunity to use the ambassadors. I will caution you, you know, my wife works in politics, and she always talks about staying on message. You know, that's my big concern about the ambassadors. How do you train them and prepare them so that they are staying on message? And actually, first and foremost, training them to understand the messages, right? I mean, so as you're disseminating some of these study findings, I mean, some of these things are not that easy to articulate. I know I would have difficulty talking about what certain results from a trial meant. And so while I think it's a really good insight to use the ambassadors in this way because of their spread throughout the country, I would just caution you about how you're using them and, you know, forcing you to think about how you're going to prepare them to do that work.
I think that's really helpful. I think to your first point about sort of the different types of opportunities, such as merit review, I think there's not an expectation that anyone who's an ambassador would be a good candidate for merit review. I think there's a diversity of opportunity. Some people would love merit review and would gravitate toward that opportunity and go through the training and see if they could be a merit reviewer. Others might want to do different activities. So, but that's a really good thing to keep in mind, that it's hard to market something that's so broad. So it's going to be, continue to work with our communications folks about sort of marketing and making sure people have a strong sense for what this looks like. So I appreciate that.
I'd like to also add that, Darius, about the, you know, communicating research results and the challenge of that, something that we're entertaining is that an opportunity for the ambassadors would be to be a peer reviewer at the end of project life cycle, because legislatively we are required to have a peer review and then a lay summary report. And so we're thinking that maybe the ambassadors could help us look at those lay summaries for readability and understandability. So we would, of course, offer some training. But so we want to see, how do we take the ambassadors and plug them back in, because they've got the principles. A lot of them have the desire to stay engaged in some way. So we're looking at all these possible touch points of engagement, including something that would possibly mitigate some of your concerns about that.
Another group that might be an area for growth and participation are the applicants for the openings that are in place right now for the advisory panel.
So Perry really sums it up beautifully for me as well, because I'm equally technologically challenged. So I also had a really hard time getting through the training, and I don't know if I actually did, so any help I could get would be great. But my one comment is to go back to something else that Perry had talked about, is, and you know, what we were saying earlier, what Sarah said, that meeting people where they're at. And you know, for those who are not in that technology age, you know, figuring out maybe those other ways to communicate with them. I don't know if it's worthwhile to send a survey to the ambassadors to say, how do you best receive information? I mean, I know for myself, I would respond with, I answer all your emails, but knowing how to get on Yammer or Chatter, I have no idea. So I'm just wondering if a survey would help, and going to the ambassadors and saying, how do you receive, you know, how would you like to receive this information? What's easiest for you?
Part of the work we're doing is checking back in and trying to figure out those best ways to communicate. And I know Anya has worked very closely with our training folks too. We've updated and tried to refine the training, because there were some challenges with our first the first contractor we worked with, and so hopefully the training will just continue to improve. So I really appreciate these inputs.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments. The first one is, I struggled with the software for the training as well. I finished the first module, got bumped out, got reinstated in, my password didn't work, and I gave up. So So I think that you know, we probably want to make it easier for people to go through the training. It should be pretty seamless. It's not that difficult a course. And I wondered if part of the value proposition might be that we have people going out to their communities, telling them what the grants are that are available, and bringing those people back in. And if that's the case, then there is an obvious value-added proposition here, which is namely that you're creating a pool of consultants. And those people go out and they, you know, are giving speeches, and people approach them afterwards to be involved in projects and things like that. I don't know if that's something that appeals to PCORI as a value proposition, but it is an obvious one that's there.
And I first want to say thank you for this program. I know we all worked very hard to have it in place. But I would like to express a few concerns. I think the ambassador program, it should be a many are called but fewer chosen. You know, I struggle to understand why one would take this exam and not be an ambassador or even an evangelist for PCORI. Just to take an exam, or should I, let me say this, I think we need to focus on the quality of our ambassadors versus the quantity. Why one would take an exam and possibly not want to share this this great program and of the Affordable Care Act, is, I think it's beyond me. Possibly because I work with high-risk populations, and I understand the need that this is a PCORI organization is something we've been waiting for and have been in need for decades. So I wear PCORI on my sleeve. I'm called a PCORI lady in my community and beyond, and I'm proud of that badge. So I take every opportunity to get in front of people, talk, and I plug myself into every opportunity. And I also morph talking points into PCORI points to get people in. And I've had a lot of success with it. I will say the exam was, I was challenged. I'm glad I passed. I think it would have been a little embarrassing if I did, but I tried and I kept it and I got it. It was, I think it was a little more difficult than some of the board exams that I took, but that's okay. That's value. It shows that those of us who have passed are serious about it. But once you've passed it and you've got your certificate, don't put it on a shelf, you know. So I think we've got to determine how we're going to not only add value to the program, but challenge those who of us who are ambassadors, how are we using it to spread the PCORI word and the mission about research and really bringing in communities and stakeholders who have not been part of the conversation with PCORI. So I could talk all day, but I won't. But thank you for this.
Just a few things. I actually loved the comprehensive training program because I felt like it was just a great review. But I do have a question. Is this an annual review, or is this something once you've done it, you've done it? So I don't know if I need to do it again or where we are with this. But then secondly, the interview. I know somebody, I'm not sure who it was, tried to set up an interview with me just to talk about, you know, the ambassador program, you know. But I have to say, it didn't work out just because of scheduling and timing. But I think a survey, a hardcore click here, survey, add your comments would have been great. And I say that because I don't feel like I was a participant as an ambassador to really even give a lot of comments about it this year. Last year, I felt like I was more engaged than I am this year as an ambassador. The other thing, too, to Kim's point, the electronic pieces, you know, Twitter, all this stuff. I'm not a Twitterer, so I don't know really what that language is. But, yes, I can do Facebook. I can do emails. I can give input that way. But just to have one more platform, it's like, oh, my gosh, you know, and I agree. I've been on there a few times to see what that was like, but it was almost like just way above my head, but it was the same couple of people, too. So I felt like you did as far as that goes. So just a few comments. Thanks.
Just one more comment. Okay.
Brittany Clyatt to take us into the pipelines. Give us an update on what's happening besides all of us reading letters of LOIs night and day right now. But Courtney's going to bring you up to date on that and talk about our strategic future and strategic plan for the future. And then we can have questions after that.
Thank you, Sue, and good morning, everyone. It's a little chilly in here, so I'm wearing a scarf. I see some people have coats. so let's see. Mm-hmm. I just want to apologize to everyone. I'm going to be jumping in and out of the room for a few minutes. It looks like I might have a burst pipe in my basement, and so I'm negotiating with plumbers right now. So I just don't want you to think that I'm dissing you or Courtney or the important work that we're talking about today. Thank you, Jane. So as Sue stated, I'll give you basically an update on the activities of the Pipeline Proposal Program since the last time we met. And as you can see here, this is the general overview. I'll be talking about our Pipeline Award Program offices that have been contracted as of last night at 9 p.m., the letters of intent that we've received, what we're doing now with them, and then other activities that have taken place during the time since we last met, including a presentation for NAPCREG, our end of awardee meeting, and our strategic planning session that we conducted with the engagement team looking at the future of the Pipeline to Proposal Initiative. So I can finally formally announce selected Pipeline Award Program offices by region. In the Eastern region, we have Health Resources in Action. They're located in Boston. In the Midwest region, we have Michigan Public Health Institute. For the national region, or national PAPO, we have the National Network of Public Health Institutes. For the South, we have the Georgia Health Policy Center, and we're continuing with Colorado Foundation for Public Health and the Environment in the Western region. So as was mentioned, we are currently reviewing up to 298 LOIs that we've received for this funding opportunity. I just provided you here with a breakdown of the number that we received per region. We received the most in the southern region, and we feel that this is a pretty good spread in terms of the number and also the quality of LOIs that we've received. We are in the process of reviewing them right now. Our engagement team staff are pitching in with this review, some of us taking up to 70 or so, others of us taking as many as we can handle. But we're moving forward with that, and we will begin announcing those who are now invited to apply and complete a full proposal. We'll begin announcing that this coming Friday.
What is national? What does that represent?
So the national region represents those projects that will take place between regions. So let's say there's someone in California that wants to work with someone in Florida. They would be managed, their award would be managed by the national region. The national region also entails U.S. territories, such as Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and we did receive a couple of LOIs from those territories as well. Okay. So the next item on my overview is the pipeline to proposal activities that have taken place. I mentioned that I presented at the North Atlantic Primary Care Research Group, their pre-conference meeting back in November, and that was primarily an educational opportunity for those who were in attendance and were interested in possibly applying or hearing more about PCORI and applying for a pipeline of proposal award opportunity. We also conducted a pipeline of proposal webinar, which was primarily for the purpose of giving people information about how they can get involved, not only with PCORI, but also in applying to the Pipeline and Proposal Program. We provided them also with an update. The update was pretty much the same information that I shared with all of you the last time that we met. just giving them an understanding of the fact that Tier 1 and Tier 3 are now the only opportunities for them to jump into the pipeline. Back in November, we had a meeting with all of our awardees, and you know, they shared some of their learnings, and they actually requested to meet more often or and sooner in their award process. The majority of them also expressed a very great interest in moving forward to Tier 2. I have a couple of video, or three videos rather, that I'll be sharing with you. They're very short, but it's video interviews that I conducted with the with three of the awardees. And then I'll also show you some of the outcome of our strategic planning session that we did with the team. And we were primarily focusing on, we did a SWOT analysis, and we're primarily focusing on the opportunities that we see for this program. So, let's see. Our strategic planning session that we did with the team was basically a way for us to make sure that we all had a full understanding of what the Pipeline and Proposal Program is, where it fits in the PCORI research enterprise, and then also how, you know, how it can be developed and modified to meet the growing needs of the organization. So, let's see. We affirm that it comes in at the very beginning, actually before the research process should begin. It's basically your pre-planning stage where prior to, you know, doing recruitment for a study, this is an opportunity for researchers and patients and other stakeholders to have a chance to actually develop an idea from its nascent stage into a proposal that could possibly then be funded. So among the opportunities we identified, the importance of aligning the Pipeline and Proposal Program with science funding priorities. You know, as of now, the Pipeline and Proposal Program is open. There's no specific health issue that you have to identify. And in some cases, we've had some LOIs and even some awardees who were funded in the last period who didn't yet identify a health issue, but they had their population, and they decided that it was important for them to bring their population together to identify the most important health issue that they should then come to focus on. So, you know, as I said, you know, right now we're completely open and we're not yet targeted, but given the possible direction of PCORI possibly moving into targeted funding announcements and funding opportunities, we identify the fact that the Pipeline and Proposal Program will also need to line up with that so that when people have completed the pipeline, that there is room for them within PCORI funding opportunities, that they could more easily fit into that. We've identified the fact that we need to improve information and communication about the Pipeline and Proposal Program, and one of our first steps of doing that was doing the webinar that we held on December 3rd, providing greater information out there so people really could have an understanding of really what the difference is between the Pipeline to Proposal Program and the engagement awards, as well as other funding opportunities for that PCORI offers. Doing outreach also to junior researchers, community health organizations, and even using some of our own staff who participate in speaking engagements to, you know, talk a bit more about other opportunities for some of those non-traditional researchers. So I've kind of jumped ahead of myself. And so, speaking yet again about that that improvement of external communication, so we've discussed that we need to develop a national and regional targeted outreach plan that will align with science and will put patients and stakeholder and will reach out primarily to priority patient and stakeholder communities. You know, we've had some learnings from this first go-around of funding from the first cohort, and so we're still gathering some of those learnings now, but we are seeing some very promising practices in community engagement and patient engagement. And so we, you know, we have high hopes that we'll be able to do some publication in the near future about some of those learnings. One of the main things that we focused on during our strategic planning session was to look at program development, particularly looking at building out Tier 3, and then also looking at how we can incorporate dissemination into the pipeline and proposal structure. As it is now, you know, basically it's you come to the table with an idea, you bring people together to discuss that idea, you develop a communications plan, a governance plan, and then you move that idea forward to developing comparative effectiveness research questions around that health topic, and then, you know, you develop a proposal in the Tier 3 stage. But, you know, we really recognize the fact that we have some already promising research practices and ideas out there and interventions out there that we need to make sure that there are ways to get that information out to communities. So as such, we are looking at building in a dissemination concept into the proposal, the pipeline proposal build out. Additionally, I mentioned that we are looking at strategically building out Tier 3. And so, you know, of course, we do welcome ideas from any of you that you may have in regard to how we can really tighten, strengthen Tier 3. You know, we're looking at the opportunity for people who have already applied for funding from PCORI but may not have had a very strong engagement plan and may have, for that reason, been not invited to either issue a full proposal or invited to, or I don't want to say rejected, but not approved for funding, for them to kind of jump into the pipeline at Tier 3 and, you know, kind of build out how they can work with their communities. And as I mentioned, we also want to identify how the pipeline and proposal program aligns with other PCORI programmatic areas. Anya mentioned some of the activities that ambassadors can undertake, including possibly reviewing proposals, as well as having our pipeline to proposal awardees speak with the ambassadors to share their experiences and giving ambassadors a further understanding of what this initiative is. So the future direction of the Pipeline of Proposal Awards primarily will focus on opportunities to cross-pollinate with other program areas. We will, as I mentioned, begin to align the Pipeline of Proposal Awards with PCORI's future research funding priorities, and we'll look at promising practices on community engagement and partnership development that will be shared with a broader research community. So that we're not yet going to break, so I'm going to ask our AV person to queue up the videos that I wanted to share with you. And this is Katie Wilkes. She's a patient awardee. She's a melanoma survivor, and she's going to talk. She's going to mention a little bit about her project.
If they would be interested in getting involved, maybe having some sort of a screening component at my event. And while I was in there meeting with her, I mentioned that I was a reviewer for PCORI and that they had this really cool new funding opportunity that would allow patients and researchers to work together in new ways. And so 2 hours later, I was leaving her office, and we were writing a proposal together. We've used PCORI funds to create a website, to create a logo for the organization, as well as to have a presence at several different outreach events where melanoma patients were present in both states. And I think that the biggest, most exciting thing that I've been involved in during our project period was to help Dr. Leachman get the new Melanoma Community Registry up and running at Oregon Health and Science University. And And this is something that since May has over 2,000 melanoma patients from the state of Oregon now in the registry. And I was able to play an advisory role in the development of that. Dr. Leachman is the PI on the registry. And going forward, I'm hoping that my Soul Survivors patient advisory group can continue to play an advisory role in research projects having to do with that registry. I don't know any other individual patient advocate like myself who's able to have been a project director on a melanoma grant before. I think that's very unique, very high risk, high reward, but it's been very exciting and I think opening up a lot of opportunities.
And this is
with the PQIP funding.
Okay.
With the PQIP funding, we were able to get over 10 Asian American local media organizations to talk about stomach cancer, interview us, and have video footage of the Stomach Cancer Summit. And we were also able to reach up to 1,000 Asian Americans in Washington State to begin to raise awareness about not only who is at risk, but what they might be able to start doing from a healthy nutrition and lifestyle perspective to prevent stomach cancer. I mean, there are thousands of academic research papers that are written about stomach cancer worldwide, and most of it will never be read or understood by most people. The fact that PCORI really emphasizes working with community members and disseminating what we're finding in a way that's easy to understand puts a discipline to our work and makes sure that we are not only thinking about the research end of this project, but thinking about how it's going to have a real-life impact.
And then there's one more. So Suzanne Pack is, she is a stakeholder. She runs the Cornerstone Medical Services in Federal Way, Washington. And this last interview is from Dr. Nguyen. He is a researcher from Loma Linda University, and his project focus is on sepsis.
Initially, I had the idea of let's find a treatment for the post-sepsis syndrome, comparing drug A versus drug B. So we actually went to the literature and decide or try to discover what are drugs out there to help. But when we talked to the patient, we soon found out that they're not really focused on the drugs. There's actually other issues that we need to address. One particular patient gave us the idea of a whole person care. So whole person care can include both the mental, the physical, and the spiritual. Two reasons that I think the PCORI funding is very unique and help us fill the gap is, number one, as we develop our comparative effectiveness infrastructure at my institution, we are learning. So the traditional funding already require existing infrastructure. We do not yet have the infrastructure. Number two, again, the post-sepsis syndrome is very new, so there's not a lot of funding opportunity out there as far as patient engagement. So combining those two, this particular funding absolutely fill a gap that we wouldn't be able to achieve with other traditional funding.
That's it. I'll take any questions at this time. I saw Regina first. I'm sorry.
Now, first I want to say thank you for this. This is really great. I'm really glad to see that the program is spreading east. You know, it's been a long time in the making, but it's very, very good. One of the comments that I had was, and those videos were very good. You know, it really gives us a sense of really seeing non-traditional researchers being involved and convening proposals and study, so that's really excellent. It's really it's helpful to see that. It validates what other people are trying to do, and I think, you know, really promoting and sharing this with publics and even ambassadors like me, I would really like to take these videos to some of when I have my ambassador events to really share videos like this so they can see real life community people actually being activated to get involved with research, and they can do it in a very meaningful way. It doesn't have to be large, but really just having beginning a conversation really gives them the impetus. So I just want to thank you for that. It was great.
Thank you, Regina. And that is actually one of the reasons why I wanted to do the interviews, so that, you know, I know for sure what the projects are doing, and you know, our team for the most part has some knowledge as well, but this is a great opportunity for us to also showcase it outside of, you know, just our internal environment.
One last comment. $15,000 for the first year is very generous. You know, most organizations, I'm an ambassador with the American Heart Association as well, and their community grants are like $5,000. So they use those dollars to add in, but you can actually jumpstart a real an infrastructure very nicely with the initial the tier one $15,000. So it's very generous.
Yes. So I want to echo Regina's comments. This is a wonderful, wonderful initiative. It's great to see the variety of programs that have been funded. The testimonials are very compelling. I had two questions. One is more of a factual one, which is I saw that 30 projects were funded for Tier 1. I wondered what the number of submissions were about. Do you have a sense of that?
For Tier 1 Cycle 1, we received 109 applications.
Okay.
And so just for a little bit of background, the first time that we had this funding opportunity, we only received applications. We didn't go through the LOI process. And when we were reviewing those applications, we realized that there were a number of them that came through that didn't necessarily fit this funding opportunity. And so we decided to go ahead and do a competitive LOI process. And in this case, you know, I'm not sure just yet. We actually have a meeting later today and then one next Tuesday to look at the number that will then be invited to proposal. But we're probably looking at maybe about 30 to 40% going forward.
Yeah. So I think that's helpful for a couple reasons. Number one is, you know, if you don't have much time and you're doing this as a voluntary activity, you kind of don't want to know what your odds are. And much below 20 to 30% probably isn't worth the time. So I think making that explicit, giving people an indication, I think is really helpful. I think the LOI process for these projects is also really, really important and valuable, and will help signal both what the Corps is interested in, but also, you know, kind of help folks who may not really know what they're doing kind of get up to speed. So I think that's really, really valuable. The other, I have two kind of related points. One is that I suspect that the importance and contribution of these projects, pound for pound, outweighs anything else in the portfolio, including the Cornet and the $10 million pipeline or big awards. I mean, my impression is that from everything I've seen, that people come up with really creative, interesting, innovative ideas that can then be scaled. And, you know, to support 30 grants for $10,000, $450,000, something like that, plus administration, that is like rounding error for the Corps. And if anything, you know, the number and size of these awards should be scaled up over time. I think there's an enormous opportunity there. The other thing is that, and my last point, if you're counting, is that it may be that there are different kinds of comparative effectiveness research, and that while the methodology committee is spending a lot of energy and interest and attention on things like pragmatic clinical trials, which I really don't understand what they are anyway, but they're spending a lot of time on those and trying to understand how to do comparative effectiveness research with large databases linking all kinds of things, I think there may be a lot of value at looking at really small projects, demonstration projects, qualitative work, things that are really accessible to small efforts initiated at the scale here. So in many ways, I would think about this activity as the incubator and encourage the organization to pay attention to it out of proportion to the size of the activity and not see the goal as necessarily moving from 1 to 2 to 3, building the capability of small individuals to eventually become partners with large investigators, but to really revolutionize the way we think about the research enterprise and, you know, how we define research.
And thank you for that. And, you know, that's one of the things when you look at this program, you have to realize that, you know, dollar for dollar, the return on investment may not match exactly, but the fact is that you're planting the seeds in the community. And in terms of, like, developing that Peace Corps community that we're charged with doing. So thank you for that.
I mean, I would think of these like microloans in the third world, you know, where, you know, a little bit goes a long way, and, you know, the incremental value of a couple thousand dollars can be really priceless in jump-starting something. So this is wonderful work.
Yeah, I'm basically echoing the two comments that were made, but I think the videos were so helpful because when I look at the pipeline proposal work that's being done, the place where I pause is, but what is it? What, you know, what exactly is it that is going on here, you know, aside from something conceptual? And so having those actual examples is really helpful, and so I would say examples, and get them out, because I think, you know, as Saul was saying, this is an innovation project. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think that these proposals, it's the same message of hope that Saul was making, is these, you're training people how to become research participants. A lot of these people have never filled out an LOI before. They've never, you know, so they're gaining a core competency as well as reaching out in the community. So I think it's terrific work, and I agree it should be given disproportionate weight in, you know, the organization because of what it's doing.
Just to echo what others have said, I think this is fantastic work, and the videos are, you know, very exciting to see, especially given that it's clear that the funding and the relationships that are being built are extending beyond what this program's intention was, and that was to, you know, lead to potentially a proposal. But there's a lot of things that are happening outside because of the relationship that's developing, and it's important for PCORI to be able to capture that because it's, again, demonstrating how you're shaping the outside environment, you know, and the innovation and things that are happening outside of the grant itself, I think is critical.
Thank you. Laurel.
I think that it's really important to have these videos and to have more information out because it appears to me, or what I've noticed, is that organizations or some will go way beyond what you would expect for a tier one or a in the pipeline. So they've already got the researcher, they've got their patients, they've got the idea, they've got the framework, they've got everything, but they don't have the LOI, and they don't have the actual, they haven't actually taken the first step. They've taken many steps, but they haven't taken the first step to step into PCORI. And I'm wondering if maybe there's a way to help move that along to encourage people that, yes, I think you're already ready, so let's go.
Like a rubric for pre-engagement?
Excellent idea.
And that is an idea that has been bandied about. I will say, though, that as you can see, we've done a lot of work within the last few months even, and much of what I'm reporting to you, but then there's a lot of stuff that hasn't necessarily been reported. So I will say that is an idea, as I said, that has been discussed, and, you know, hopefully it's in the making. But there's a lot of other work that we also need to get to get there. And I'll also say that, you know, we fielded a number of phone calls and emails from folks who were questioning whether or not, you know, they should go ahead and They had their group and they had their health issue, but they weren't sure. And so, you know, it's just a matter of encouraging sometimes folks to just reach out there, do it. I mean, we tried to make our LOI as easy and, you know, not as complicated as possible, so that, you know, for a lay person who isn't used to this stuff, that they would be able to do it. And I, you know, there for all of the people that I know that I talk to directly, all of them, you know, they did eventually apply. Now, whether or not, you know, going through that LOI stage, one of the things that we're asking reviewers to do is if you know, when as you're scoring the different components, please give us comments so that we can be sure to get that information back to those submitters so that, you know, if they didn't do so well this time, they can learn and then also resubmit for the next time. And then, too, you know, that is one of the important things about, you know, doing these videos and doing from the perspective of a researcher who thought he had an idea and he, you know, once he got involved or really meeting his patient community, that whole idea switched and he realized, you know what I thought isn't the most important thing to the patient community, so this is what we're going to go with. And, you know, a melanoma survivor who in the past had said that she'd had doors like closed in her face because she's this one person and nobody really wanted to hear anything from her. But, you know, when she could say, she could walk into a room kind of with the weight of PCORI behind her, it kind of gave her a bit of gravitas and people were willing to hear what she had to say. So I think that, you know, as my understanding is that our communications team is interested in putting these videos not only on our website, but, you know, as Regina mentioned, you know, it's something that we can do in terms of sharing with our ambassadors, with our advisory panel. You know, as you go out and you represent PCORI, as an ambassador, this is something that you can point to say that, you know, we are doing research differently to a certain degree.
Yep. One other thought, which is, you know, we talk a lot about the ways in which patients, families, and supporters are expert in a way that researchers might not. And, you know, I wonder, as you think about the pipeline solicitations, whether there may be an opportunity to focus on that. So, for example, areas where patients and families and caregivers are expert are things like access, adherence, dissemination. Those are the kinds of areas where they uniquely know what some of the challenges and obstacles are. And that could be cross-cutting, the way that Dr. Luke discussed this morning, or they could be disease-specific. So just one more thought.
I was just going to suggest you start with the videos when you talk about this program, because I think it really does give a contextual presence to the power of these types of awards that then I would have appreciated maybe the pie charts a little more after seeing just some of the real-world descriptions about how they've been carried out.
And just one more comment. Something Lorraine said really resonated with me, the development of core competence. Then I look at, you know, one of the year slides, the external course of action. You know, we talk about targeted populations and PCORI's priority populations that really lend to the fifth bullet, the underserved, underrepresented patient populations and rare diseases. Are you finding that many of your awardees have that as a focus in assisting not only their communities, but others, especially the, you know, the doctor at Loma Linda, really assisting in the development of core competencies so that those who may have communities already developed but are afraid to, I'll just use the term leap of faith and submitting an LOI, because submitting the LOI, if you don't have the experience or a research partner, to develop an LOI is. It's a difficult thing to do. And Corey does have the great guidelines on how to write a LOI, but there are those who still need that assistance in doing that. I don't know if they, and coaching is very important. So I'm thinking possibly the successful awardees can be mentors or even ambassadors to assist even the LOI process for those who want to take that next step to do to pursue PCORI funding for their project.
And Regina, a little to your point, I will say that some of our regional workshop meetings that we've had in the past and other opportunities that people have had to go out and speak on PCORI as well as the Pipeline and Proposal Program have generated some applications. When I did my presentation at the NAPCREG meeting, there were at least 5 people that I understand that were planning to submit LOIs as a result of that presentation. And in terms of mentoring or coaching from the current awardees to potential LOI submitters, you know, that's something that, you know, perhaps we can discuss with the current awardees. They will tell you right now that they're very tapped out. But, you know, it is certainly, you know, they have experiences that others can learn from. So, you know, that's something that could possibly be made available. And in other cases, like, there are some cases where some folks had actually already worked on a project or were involved with either the advisory group that was working on a specific project, and then they decided, you know what, let's take this and actually, you know, maybe develop it larger in another community. So there's some cross-fertilization happening as well. Some of them are ambassadors. Actually, one of our awardees came from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she first had the experience of hearing about the Pipeline and Proposal Program at our regional meeting or regional workshop that we did in Albuquerque. So, yeah.
Is there a question, perhaps, or somewhere a box that they could check? How did you hear about PCORI?
Yes, that is actually on our LOI form, and there, you know, there are some pre-filled out things. I think it's like a drop-down or a check. Okay. And so there's some things that are pre-filled out, and then there are other, you know, you have the option for other, and so we ask them to specify what that other is. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Everyone, thank you for that presentation. Both presentations this morning have been really informative. And for the discussion, we now have a 15-minute break, so we will reconvene actually at 11 a.m., so 20 minutes, a little 5-minute bonus. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to start. For those of you on the telephone, we're going to start now with the discussion on the compensation framework. And Charlotte Collins, our chair of the PEEP, and Suzanne Trant will conduct this conversation.
And thanks again, everyone, for your attention to this and for your engagement. And I want to begin with a little background. So, of necessity, I have to thank members of the subcommittee that volunteered, were appointed, or dragged in last year when this issue of compensation came up. And by compensation, we were really focusing on whether and how PCORI should articulate any demands or restrictions on compensation or requirements for compensation for the research team for patients who are engaged in
those research activities that do not include acting as research subjects. So that's an important delimiter that we tried to make as a subcommittee. And as a subcommittee, we really went through looking at some models from around the world, as well as here at home, got input from a number of folks outside of the subcommittee, and the subcommittee came back at least twice with draft proposed language. What you have in front of you is the model, is the language that we shared with you when we came together the last time, but with modifications made since our last meeting, and that's why we're bringing this back to you again. What we want to get out of this is an endorsement of this language. We're not out to, you know, kind of beat this to death, and I know there's some of us who, you know, kind of are going, what compensation again? But it's really an important and active issue and conversation, not just within PCORI at large, but also within some of the other advisory panels. So with that, I'm actually going to turn this over to Suzanne right now to talk about some of those pieces of information that she's gathered since we came together last time to discuss this and to talk about the specific changes and tweaks that were made in the draft document that you have before you. And what you should have before you and printed out in the packet is the two-page compensation of patients, caregivers, and patient caregiver organizations engaged in PCORI-funded research as engaged partners.
Sure. Thank you, Charlotte. So just a few notes on sort of the changes that were made from the original draft that was crafted by the subcommittee. We had our legal counsel at PCORI review, and essentially any of the edits were really about making a really sharp distinction between subjects and participants. So mild word changes, like there was something about participation in focus groups, and while we still sort of have an active debate about this notion of can you, what are all the different roles a patient partner could play and when do you become a subject, it felt important for this compensation framework to be very clear. So we removed that and said, no, this would be more about designing and conducting focus groups, not participating in. So it's just about drawing those sharp lines. There was a paragraph in the original compensation draft that actually addressed subjects and said we do feel there's also an important value in compensating research subjects, and that actually sort of really falls within the ambit of a whole different conversation, and that has to go to the Institutional Review Board approval, and it's a whole different layer. So we really wanted to focus this on participants, on partners in the research, not on the subject. And so that's what our legal counsel did, was sort of just a really keen eye for those sorts of distinctions. As Charlotte said, this is not only a hot topic with the PEEP, it is a hot topic everywhere, and we get this question all the time. And actually, the other advisory panels have asked about this. When I stepped out yesterday, it was to go speak to the Rare Disease Advisory Panel. They wanted to know what's going on with compensation. I gave them a bit of a teaser that you all have drafted a framework, but I wasn't at liberty to share it yet. And they actually had some really interesting insights from the rare disease perspective, just things that maybe hadn't surfaced in our conversations. One was that because the rare disease community is naturally smaller and you've got a smaller pool of people, that there have been occasions where there actually can be bidding wars between projects, that you're trying to incentivize people to come participate, but you've got a small pool of people. So that's something we should think about. I don't think that's a reason to not compensate, but it's certainly an interesting issue. The other one was about the word compensation, because the word compensation is also tied to providing financial value to human subjects in research, but we talked about it and didn't derive another term. So right now, compensation is still, you know, where we are. I also went and spoke to the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel. That conversation was supposed to be about data safety monitoring, and we ended up talking for about 15 minutes about compensation because it is a hot topic. Now, they didn't have specific pieces of advice or anything to necessarily report out on, except to say this is challenging. It's something everyone is looking at and facing. So I think this could potentially be something that, you know, all advisory panels have want to either contribute to or provide input on, particularly those patient partners. And actually the rare disease panel asked, you know, what can they do to help? Could they offer some patient representatives from their panel to contribute? So I just offer that to let you know that this is something that's really important to everybody.
And what do you see as next steps? In other words, what's going to happen to this next?
First is to ensure that the PEEP is comfortable with this language, that it captures the spirit of everything that we've been talking about for the past year. And then we will begin the vetting process within PCORI itself. Like we did the rubric, you know, we agreed on a document, and then we had our science team review it. We had our leadership review it. Our other directors review it, and then we had Joe review it. And if it needs back to legal or even the ethics board of the committee will take it down that path. But it will go into a vetting process at PCORI.
Now, does it really express the intent rather than wordsmithing at this point? So thank you for being mindful of that. And I see more cards for those of you on the phone. We've got a lot of comments, so we'll go ahead and get started. And I'm going to, let's say we'll go counterclockwise and start with Steve in the back.
So first of all, congratulations to everyone who has worked on this. Obviously, this has been a lot of work. And two brief comments. One, I know there's some discussion around compensation may vary given different levels of engagement. We should just be mindful that during the course of a research project, people's roles may vary at different times within that project. So that's one thing to consider. And then the last thing, and this is something I've mentioned before, in terms of declining compensation, that should be for any reason, not just because of any restrictions. That's a personal choice.
That is a perfect segue to what I was going to comment on. So I agree. It's a very well-done document and lays out everything beautifully. My only comment is just from the parent perspective, and I know working on the pilot projects and talking with some of the other patient partners, one of the things that was expressed was, you know, I'm so committed to this, I don't feel comfortable taking a stipend. I was actually one of those people, and really it was important that a patient who was more seasoned than I was had to take me a step back and say, you may not feel comfortable with it. We can figure out other ways of, you know, maybe you can donate it, but it's also an important statement because it shows that you are truly a partner on the team. So we struggle with this all the time with our projects. And I just think, you know, in terms of what Steve was saying, you know, maybe an additional resource would be if you are uncomfortable taking it, here are some things you can do, you know, you can do with that stipend money.
You know, this is really great. You know, I want to have one question. How will this be folded, or will our engagement rubric be updated to reflect anything that's new in this?
I think that's a great question. I think we would probably want to reflect the language. We've got a compensation section in the rubric under the partnership engagement principle, and we just have a statement there, so I think it'd be easy to extract. And we also, in our applicant FAQs and our guidance for applicants when they submit a funding proposal. We aren't silent on compensation. We have a couple places where we address it, so we'd want to make sure we provide it as a resource once it's sort of all the way vetted and up the chain.
Right. And I see this document also as advisory to both researchers and patient communities. It's empowering to the patient communities to understand and be advised that their time and level of engagement and participation is of value, and for researchers who I've spoken with, and they're very I'm grateful to say I'm working with a very good group. They're extremely mindful and grateful for the participation levels of their community and patient partners as well. So this works both ways. Also, as far as language, has there been any discussion or questions with the word compensation, which I love because it annotates really scope of work that you're being that we'll all agree that will be in a proposal versus stipends and incentives, which incentives are for maybe focus groups or people who are invited to give information, and it's a gratuity, if you will, for maybe a focus group participation or an incentive versus a stipend. Has there been any discussion? Because I'm clear on compensation, but stipends and incentives. Has there been any questions or comments as far as the difference or distinctions between that?
I mean, one of the things we're seeing come to fruition, particularly with the work of the engagement officers in funded projects right now, is often projects have to be very creative about how they provide funding or provide compensation. Sometimes patient partners are employees of the university that receives the funding. Sometimes they are consultants and they receive it that way. If those options aren't available, sometimes it's provided as a stipend. But I don't know that we've laid out, and certainly in the guidance we provide applicants, I don't know that we lay out sort of different permutations, but we've seen it come to life, and we're seeing all these different ways to provide resources to the partners.
And then lastly, the third paragraph, this is really advisory. This is really good, really to really understand the engagement of research partners versus human subjects. And so this is really good. Thank you.
I just have a quick question. As this filters down and goes into like a research consent form, is it made perfectly clear to those patients that they are going to be compensated, and what does compensation entail, a W-9, so that they're not blindsided by that?
And Laurel, thank you for reminding me, because Laurel actually asked this question a while back about. This is actually unrelated to partners on funded projects. It was something that PCORI did a call out to our ambassadors to see if we could have some folks involved in a – it doesn't matter, but they were going to fill out some – review some materials for a project. And in the initial call, it said, let us know if you're available. Some compensation will be provided. But this person was not necessarily familiar with the concept of receiving compensation for this activity as a patient, so she was a little bit jarred when she was asked for her Social Security number and to fill out a W-9. So I think it's an important piece that we just want to be very clear that compensation comes with the need to verify your identity. We have to be accountable for the money that we give to our awardees, and so we can't just, you know, give cash. We're going to need to have some sort of paper trail. So I think it's an important piece just to be very clear, especially to people that might not be familiar with kind of how this works. That's an important thing to keep in mind.
Just to add a quick clarifying question on this. My understanding in reading this is outside of the IRB informed consent process. So for someone to participate as a partner, they don't have to go through consent.
Right. And I think this would be for people serving on the research team as consultants, as partners, et cetera. If you were a human subject being involved in that way, any incentives, anything like that is going to be an IRB issue outside of PCORI.
Thanks. So I have a couple specific observations. First of all, I do commend the subcommittee. I think the language is really appropriate, nicely framed, and scopes the issue very nicely. A couple of wordsmithy things that I would encourage you to think about. So, for example, it's not clear to me that people who are more engaged should necessarily get paid more. I could be highly engaged and spend almost no time on a thing, and I could be, you know, kind of casually engaged and spend a lot of time on something. So I think the term level of engagement is a little confusing. And the way that researchers talk about it is the level of effort. If you put a lot of effort into it, meaning time, then that would be more highly compensated than something you put less effort into. And so I think about that. There's also two places in the document where we talk about the level of engagement consistent with other members of the team. And I think there's a little bit of ambiguity in what that means. If I'm compensated consistent with other members of the team, does that mean that I get the same, an equivalent amount as other members of the same of the team, or does it mean that I'm compensated in proportion to my effort, which may be more or less depending on my role in the project, as Steve was saying? I think what you mean to say that it's kind of commensurate with my role, and that seems perfectly reasonable and appropriate, and maybe, you know, commensurate with my role as compared with members of the team. But I would just be careful because I think there's a little bit of ambiguity there. Let's see. What's that one? Oh, third thing is there are all kinds of compensation that come from being part of a research enterprise. And I have often had physician colleagues participate on research projects and get no financial compensation, but they get co-authorship. And that is, you know, status and money in the bank and, you know, in other than financial terms. So I might just call this financial compensation of patients, caregivers, and so forth. If you mean more than financial compensation, then I would include some reference to the other kinds of compensation that individuals get from being members of a research team, including authorship, access, status, whatever else, you know, you think, the other goodies that come along with it. So I just be careful about that word. And then lastly, I think this is probably implicit, but when we talk about compensating research partners on an hourly basis, a half day or so forth, many folks will be employees of, some people will be not employed, some people will be employed in other areas of endeavor, and some folks will be full-time employees of advocacy and other organizations. I don't think you meant to imply, I mean, the way it normally works is if I have somebody who works for an advocacy organization working on this project 5%, we pay the advocacy organization for their time unless there's a kind of a moonlighting arrangement. I think it's sort of implicit in the way this is written, but just, you know, it's just a loophole. Okay.
Ditto to most of what everybody else has said, and kudos. I think it's great language for a guidance document, and for me, I think from the discussions that we've had over the past year, it hits the three things that were important to me, just addressing the human research as participants, the various levels, and where I think, Saul, you pointed this out as ambiguous, thank you. to me, I look at that as almost flexibility, and I think flexibility is important so that we're not streamlining down a different path. But also, I guess my question is, do we need to address anything with the IRS? Because I think it goes back to the W-9, and sometimes patients who are engaged with this kind of work, maybe for other insurance reasons or other purposes, they don't know what they don't know until they're into the middle of this. So I don't know if that's, you know, something we put in parentheses somewhere down the line, or is it just up to each individual person to figure that out? I think it's a great guidance tool.
I was just going to reinforce something, building off of what Amy said about sort of the philosophical importance of this document. Because we're in this emerging sort of state of
patients as partners in research, I think it's really important to build the foundation for the expectation for the patient partners to have the same deal, if you will, as other elements of the research enterprise, and that's laid out really nicely in the top paragraph, because I think otherwise, if there is just, you know, unless we continue to reinforce that this is a good and rightful thing for the patient partners to expect, there may always be this, well, I'm so committed to this anyway, I'm just going to go ahead and do it without compensation, which then doesn't give us a true cost of the research, because we're getting this voluntary element from one of the, you know, the patient-centered outcomes research institute, where we're tenuous about or tentative about accepting any compensation for that, then, you know, really it sort of undervalues then in the bigger scheme of things. So I just wanted to just echo how important I think this document is from a philosophical and from an evolutionary standpoint as, you know, we try to embed these principles going forward, particularly with other funders, to make sure this is in place for them to look back at.
I want to say, ditto to everything that's been said. I wanted to underline something that Saul said about authorship. I think that is a benefit, but it's a more benefit for somebody who's you know, going for tenure or something than it is for somebody like me. So, but I don't think you should be able to buy off authorship. I remember participating in research with somebody who said that I was paid as a consultant, therefore I shouldn't be a co-author. That's not right. So, with respect to I'll just stop there. Everything else has been said very well. So, I just want to congratulate the people who wrote this.
So, I think that the point about the distinction between financial compensation and other types of compensation is a really important one. I think in the spirit of, you know, patient and stakeholder engagement, we want to be clear that financial compensation is one type of incentive, and there are other types of, you know, incentives for participation. I agree with Perry that, you know, for me, you know, having a publication is more important than for Perry, but at the same time, in the spirit of doing research differently, we want all of the different patients and stakeholders that are engaged to have the opportunity to get these other types of incentives, such as authorship. So I do think that that's an important distinction. Just two other comments. One is, this is framed as a document related to patients, caregivers, and patient caregiver organizations, but thinking about the presentation yesterday that Greg and Suzanne did, there are other types of stakeholders that may also be involved, that may also be receiving this sort of financial compensation. So, you know, I was reluctant to bring that up because I don't want you to overhaul the entire language, but you may want to have a statement saying that this is also applicable to other, quote, non-research partners who are going to be engaging. And then my final comment, in some ways, might be my most important comment. I'm looking at this from the perspective of my Office of Sponsored Research at Northwestern or my Office of Sponsored Research at Hopkins, where I used to be. You know, as we're putting grants together, you know, they review budgets very carefully. And I can tell you that one of the questions that they always ask me is, why the heck are you paying these folks this amount of money? And I think that it might be useful for you to have a couple folks from these offices of sponsored research take a look at this document to see whether or not it gives them the level of detail they need to be able to be comfortable saying, yes, this patient can be paid this amount of money because this is what the Corps is suggesting in terms of financial compensation. I think that if you can get that accomplished, that would be really useful in making sure that this is going to be as valuable a document as you would like it to be.
Just one, to respond to one of your points, in terms of the other stakeholders in compensation, we did have that discussion at PCORI, recognizing that that's something that needs to be addressed as well, very much like our patient family engagement rubric was our first out of the blocks, and we wanted to get that out, address that particular the patients, caregivers, and the organizations. So it is on our minds as a possible the next step to consider this, and so we may want to craft how we message that and communicate that. But we wanted to start with this because, same thing, we didn't want to start all over this document, and we want it to be nice and crisp and clear for the patients, and then we can move on and have discussions about other stakeholders.
The only thing that I wanted to add is, as we hear other advisory panels from PCORI thinking of discussing this, what I think would be unfortunate is if each advisory panel came up with sort of a different policy on compensation. So I think that one of the things that we'll try to do from our end is to either have a general session with all of the advisory panels, or at least the chairs of the advisory panels decide how we'd want to approach this more globally than each advisory panel dealing with it separately.
That's a good idea, and it speaks to actually bringing this process to closure. A number of you have put your cards up again, so we're going to have one more pass-through, but I'm going to ask if you really have a burning comment, put your card up now, and we'll move on from there.
More of a question than a comment. In the interest of transparency, is there going to be any type of disclosure with funding and conflicts of interest for individuals that participate?
Can I comment on that? That occurred to me, too, that we may be outside of the purview of IRBs with compensation at the level of research partners, but definitely not the case with respect to conflict of interest and those types of disclosures as the institutions require them. And I know that that's been the case with me on a subcontracting arrangement.
Yeah, and that gets very complicated. Authority. You know, different states have different reporting requirements for different things. I know as a regulated industry, you know, we have certain disclosures that we have to make. So I don't know if PCORI has drawn a line in the sand in terms of, you know, what their disclosure policies are going to be around projects that they're funding.
I just had a quick question. If a person declines compensation, is that amount still factored into the cost of that research project at the bottom line?
I think we're looking at, we wouldn't want a declination, we would want a reassignment. So if you don't want to take that, is that the right way to say that, Charlotte? That maybe you would give it to your patient advocacy organization or donate it to a cause, but we would hope that you wouldn't decline. Does that make sense? Well, right, and if you're receiving federal assistance and you actually legally cannot receive this as income, then that would be a different scenario. But I think that's one of the things.
So I wanted to just underline Darius's point about the importance of engaging research administrators at various hospitals, because the way they would normally organize this would be a contract with the patient or family member with a scope of work document, and it may be that PCORI could help standardize what the contract is. The scope of work would need to be customized, but that could and should be worked on in advance. The last thing I wanted to say was that I think this is a very important next step forward, and the expectation that there'll be financial compensation for research partners is an important declarative statement and a principle. You could imagine in the future setting a bar on how much compensation there is. So, for example, there are many research studies where the principal investigator is expected to commit 10%, 15% effort in order for it to be a meaningful contribution. And I don't think we're at that point now, but I could imagine a future where you would expect your patient partners to spend a minimum of 15% effort, you know, all told on a project. And that would be, you know, a hard line in the sand, something you could track and measure.
Thanks. Is there any, does anyone have a serious problem with moving this forward? Great. And to the extent that we've captured your comments and sentiments about this and the questions that you raised and the cautionary notes that you've raised, it's been really helpful. And, Jean, if you want to bring together the chairs or, you know, invite additional participation by this panel, we'd love to do it.
Thanks.
All right. I know we are over time, so I'm going to be brief, but I wanted to take just a little bit of time to kind of update you on a couple of the activities that are going on sort of in terms of ethics and human subjects work. This is something that I am particularly interested in, so I'm always eager to share what's going on and get any ideas or questions from you. We talked a little bit at our last meeting about some of the work we had going on with data safety monitoring boards, and so I'm going to update you on that. But really, this is just sort of an informational, I'll keep it brief because I know. Do you have the, thanks, Sue. No, you're fine. And you can skip to the next one. So I'm going to just kind of take a step back because as I was thinking about our conversation last time, I really jumped in to these concepts without giving any sort of framework, and I know we all come from very different backgrounds, so I want to be sure I talk first about what each of these things is, and then I'll fill you in on kind of the activity that's going on. And really, this is sort of from my perspective, the largest amount of work is being done right now, at least from my perspective. So institutional review boards are those bodies, and you received just a one-pager with some background information before we came together. These are those bodies that actually review and approve that a research project can go forward. And so anything we fund at PCORI, anything that involves human subjects, has to have IRB approval before it can move forward. And IRBs are particularly concerned about looking at safety of the humans involved in the research. So you can imagine the confusion that PCORI-funded research causes, given that we have this requirement that patients are involved in projects not only as subjects of research, but then in addition to that, we have patients involved as partners. And so this has caused a fair amount of confusion. We've seen across our portfolio that sometimes there's delay that the IRB is saying, what is this? These patients, are they partners? Are they subjects? How does this work? Which is understandable because that's their job, is to, you know, be sure we're not taking or that the investigator isn't taking risks. In our pilot projects, we actually had several pilot projects that came together and formed a sort of a learning network, and they looked at various challenges that IRBs had with this concept of human subjects and human partners. And so they just recently presented at a conference in December their findings from their work. They actually did a survey of several pilot projects and asked sort of what happened, how did you go about getting your IRB approval, what were the main questions and points of confusion. And so I was just able to speak to the person who spearheaded that work last week. Now that their pilot projects are coming to an end, they're sort of looking for what's our next step in this. We've compiled all this great information. What do we want to do with it? And what's great is that, great is how I would put it, we have the same sort of confusion and challenge happening in our currently funded portfolio. So great from a perspective of there's no shortage of work to be done. So what I am thinking would be a great activity for us is to convene some of our current funded projects, not pilots, but actively research
researching projects who are having these same IRB challenges, as well as some that really had no challenge and had a great deal of ease in getting IRB approval. And just talking about what can we do to provide guidance or be useful. The way this works is that PCORI is removed. We don't have anything to do with IRB approval at an institution. But what could we do as a funder of this incredibly unique type of research to help move the dial a little bit and help maybe provide a white paper or some other form of guidance? So that's one of the things we're just looking at. And certainly if any of you have a burning interest to be involved in that work, we would love to get your insights. So that's one thing. Sue, if you go to the next slide. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Can you clarify, what is a white paper?
Oh, I'm sorry. So this would be just a publication that we would draft together collectively from our learnings, and then you could use it as sort of, it would be similar to the compensation framework. I mean, this is a paper that we could share as guidance to these IRBs or other interested parties. So thank you for that question. Okay. Data safety monitoring boards. This is something we talked about a great deal last time. And an easy way to think about this is sort of on a continuum. IRBs are sort of at the beginning. They have to approve the research so that it can move forward. But in some studies, and I won't get into all the reasons why you do or do not have one of these boards, these are boards that actually look at the data and information coming out of the study as it's being conducted. They also have a safety role, an oversight role, and they want to look at sort of statistics, and I'm not a statistician, so I don't know how all of the great work that they do, but they have an important safety function. And data safety monitoring boards can actually recommend to stop a research project that's in motion for a variety of reasons. And so one of the things we talked about last time, I know, was in keeping with PCORI's, you know, concepts of involving patients in all of these very important ways, we talked about shouldn't there be patient representatives on data safety monitoring boards? And so that's still a very live conversation. When we last talked, we talked a lot about what's PCORI's function. Should we be finding these patients? Should we be training them? Should we require this, or should we just strongly encourage it? And I will say that we've sort of backed up a little bit and started to really think strategically about where we can sort of best provide guidance. We don't know that we're going to play a role in facilitating these connections. We're not necessarily going to staff DSMBs because, again, these would be separate from us. This isn't something we have control over. But one of the functions that we're working on right now is sort of developing almost a job description. What would it look like for a patient that would serve on a DSMB? And very aligned with the conversation we had yesterday, who is the right patient? Is there a right patient, or does this need to be someone who comes from an advocacy organization, or what are all the various things to take into consideration with a DSMB? Here again, just as we learned with the rubric, as we've seen with IRBs, one of our richest resources is our current portfolio, because we have DSMBs right now for some of our projects that have patient representatives. So I think that's going to be a great way that we can gather learning, and as we're fleshing out sort of this job description for who these people could be, that's another, you know, I could envision maybe a rubric that looks specifically at IRBs or DSMBs and thinks about how you can really engage patients in meaningful ways in all of these things. And then the last slide, I'll just touch briefly on privacy and confidentiality, because this is another one of those areas where typically, none of these concepts are easy, but in sort of normal research where you don't have, or traditional research where you don't have patient partners involved on research teams, you can make sort of very black and white rules. Confidentiality means you maintain confidentiality of information. You don't share identifiable medical information about people that are in research. But in the research that we fund, we have patient partners that may be very vocal, maybe in public settings, sharing information about themselves, and particularly in conditions that are maybe stigmatized or a little more sensitive. We've had a lot of questions and conversations with currently funded projects about how to tackle this. We don't want to, you know, stifle. We don't want to hide the fact that we've got these great patient partners, but we want to be mindful if they have reservations or concerns about their information being out in the public domain. So this is yet another area where we're just thinking about, is there guidance we can provide? Can we say maybe When you're providing information in a public setting, you want to do it at a 30,000-foot level and not talk about your individual insurance plan or your individual lab values. Maybe you want to keep it a little bit higher. Ultimately, it's up to the person, and we want to respect autonomy, but we're thinking very long and hard about what can we learn from our current portfolio about how people are managing this and what can we provide in terms of guidance for just the last thing we would want to do is get someone in a situation that they didn't anticipate or that's unpleasant or unfortunate. But we really want to promote that there's this great work going on by these patient partners, so we want to make sure they are equally recognized and equally public just as their PIs on these projects would be. So that's just a snapshot. If anyone has questions, I just wanted to let you know kind of what's going on in these worlds. Regina?
With the PCORnet, I know this has got to be a really high topic. Are you starting to get a guidance or recommendations or whatever from the PCORnet?
JB is not in the room. Is Lorraine in the room? Sue, I might have you. So they've got a whole,
for a PCORnet.
That's ironic.
Call. Yeah, and I can tell you this is a very discussed issue within PCORnet, and there is kind of a movement and a task force that's addressing this about kind of a patient-centered IRB. So Suzanne will be kind of crossing both, over our research world and into PCORnet because it's addressing very much the same issue. So this is an important topic to PCORnet as well.
So along those lines, actually, I was just asked to be part of the work group for the data security for our CDRN. And, one of the things that I had asked, and I think it's really important when we're including patient partners, is we can kind of muddle our way through a lot of the medical lingo, and even still that's hard. But I think when it comes to IT, that's a whole other language. So I know, for instance, I've asked my group to prep me ahead of time on some of the verbiage that they may use because it is a whole new world. So just in help with other patient partners.
Absolutely, and this is something that came up yesterday in a conversation about these data monitoring boards. And what we'll hear frequently is you've got to make sure you provide enough training and education that the patient representative would be able to participate in a meaningful way. And what I think is sort of interesting to think about is everyone at the table on a DSMB is coming from a different perspective, and the fact that you've got this really complicated data or health IT, there's a fair amount of training or education that would probably be helpful to everyone on the board, and it's really incumbent on the board to honor some of the things we talk about, avoiding jargon, spelling out acronyms, making sure everyone understands each other. So it's great that the patient representative is sort of the person we're looking to sort of change the way we do business. So I agree. That's an important piece.
Just to build on what Amy said, in terms of thinking about patient participation on data safety monitoring boards, I think it's entirely appropriate, just to make sure, because, the patients certainly will have an understanding of the availability of existing treatments, the gap associated with existing treatments, the risks associated with them, and most importantly, they can tell you what is going to be acceptable in terms of the list, the level of risk for them, and I think only they can provide that context in terms of specific types of adverse events or risks, whether or not, given that benefit-risk balance, if that's something that is acceptable for them within the context of what else is out there.
Yeah, these two issues, IRBs and DSMBs, come up in the drug development context as well, very same issues. And I think that Citi, and you may have talked to Bray already, is looking at this in that space. So there's a resource there. And somebody else brought up centralized IRBs are also becoming sort of the new thing, and NIH has embraced them, so maybe there's some opportunity there to create some centralized IRBs.
Any more? Okay.
think that it's
if there's no other questions, just know that I might be reaching out to you for volunteers for some working groups or just even just input. This is something that I just think is really going to be another area where we can really lead the charge and provide a lot of really helpful guidance. So thank you.
And to just, you know, given, you know, my stakeholder background and, you know, overlap with clinical trials, I think this is an area where I certainly can, you know, reach into my organization and colleagues to provide perspectives.
Perhaps for the patient partners to have some videos like in the previous presentation of what is acceptable and what probably wouldn't be would be helpful for those people to know how much disclosure. I'm backing up to the other subject that just occurred to me.
Okay, well, we are at the end of our, is this our sixth meeting? Well, we're concluding our meeting. And we have some time now to, we've had something called call for topics. So this is if somebody wants to share something they're currently doing that they want to inform the PEEP. And also just a time for, on your reflections on this PEEP. So this is kind of a open discussion for sharing anything that you want, quite frankly. We have limited time, but if you have something to say, this is important, or if there is a question that was unanswered. Regina, I remember I asked you to hold a question. I don't remember what it was. But if there's something unanswered, this is the time. So I'll just put up your cards, and we can start. Steve, is your card up? But it will be. Okay, Amy. Oh.
I just wanted to really briefly thank everybody because this is my second meeting, and you really all made me feel very welcome and made me feel like, you know, my feedback is taken and valued. And really in particular, I wanted to thank the PEEP members, especially the ones who are rolling off, because I think all the work that you did on the rubric and the compensation work is just groundbreaking. So.
Now, I just want to say some parting words. I'm grateful to be here at this meeting. You know, I talking to Sue, I got involved with McQuarrie July 2012, and, you know, life's taken on a new flavor. I'm so proud and glad to be part of the evolution of research done differently. It's made a tremendous difference in a lot of the communities that I work with. It's actually activated them to the point of getting involved with research and actually using me as a linchpin to really come to McQuarrie and other groups to let them know what their concerns are and also stepping up to the plate to be part of research. So I'm glad of that. As you know, I've been, over the last couple of times I've been here, I've been involved with a ministerial network of pastors. So we formed a not-for-profit called Pastors for Peace Corps, and we stepped up to the plate to get involved with research and begin training training and involvement in research. So I'm glad of that. And we're looking to share that with other faith-based groups and other community groups. So I'm glad to be here. And to the partners who are rolling off, you know, it's I'll be talking to you. You will never say goodbye. And I want to say also I've had some great moments in some private conversations. And I will say this in all due respect, McQuarrie is my Frozen. I love this organization. I'm very happy to be part of this evolution. And everybody, the staff, Jean, Sue, you know, great job. And, you know, thank you for letting me be continue involved in it.
So I also am grateful for having had the opportunity to participate. And although I haven't had I won't win any awards for attendance. I certainly feel like I've been included and had a chance to contribute and to observe the tremendous progress and accomplishments of the panel. You know, as a kind of a parting shot, I would, you know, urge the group as it kind of reconstitutes itself and refocuses on what it perceives as its opportunities to add to its portfolio a role in reminding CORI about what really matters to patients. When I look at the portfolio, I see many, many initiatives and awarded grants that are focused on the care of individuals with specific diseases. Even the systems-related improvement initiatives are about, you know, the, you know, care of diabetics type 2 with eye disease and the handoff between the hospital and the, you know, the SNF or something. You know, it's very, very, very focused. And the things that patients tell us that they care about are quality, safety, pain, fear, the emotional impact of hospitalization, you know, what happens when they leave the hospital, what happens before they get to the hospital. There are all these really important, meaningful, frustrating, challenging things to patients that are very, that can be studied from a clinical effectiveness perspective, but that aren't very, very granular about what is the, you know, A1C and was it 4.2 or 5.7, you know. And so I would encourage the panel to be the conscience of the organization and to remind them that engaging patients in research is important and that in many ways, you know, the panel needs to help set the agenda and keep the organization focused on what's important to them.
That was a great comment, Saul, and I think that's got to be our foundational piece there. You know, maybe this is just remedial, but I would just like to make a recommendation because we will have some new folks coming on board, that we have a glossary. I know we have a glossary on CORI's website, but with acronyms, I mean, I still find myself, I just turned to Paul, what does DSMB mean? I forgot, you know, what is that? And so still, you know, coming from the patient family world, I'm still, you know, trying to recognize what this is. So, and I didn't see that on the website, although there is a glossary there. So I would just, you know, maybe that's remedial just for me, but I still find myself, you know, making a list of all of these acronyms. So thank you.
Charlotte and I have been sidebarring about acronyms and also thinking about the dynamics of bringing a new wave of PEAT members in and the in thinking with staff about creating kind of an onboarding booklet or something that they can read to understand, not overwhelm. So it will be interesting for us to it's huge. So I appreciate any thoughts or comments about as we evolve.
So on the topic of onboarding, you know, maybe one thing that we can think about is pairing up some of the new members with existing members and, you know, having some introductory calls or mentoring to, number one, give them someone to know when they come into the meeting, but also bring them up to speed a little bit with what we've been doing. I also wanted to thank the folks that are rolling off, and we certainly will miss you. We'll miss your wisdom, perspectives, and your camaraderie. So it's been great getting to know each of you, and hopefully that will continue. In the interest of call for topics, I did want to bring up two points which I would like to see addressed possibly in upcoming meetings. The first relates to the dissemination and implementation. I know we had met with Mathematica a little over a year ago when that project was being kicked off, and I know that the framework has gone through public comment period, and I would have expected that the PEEP would have had an opportunity to review and provide feedback and comment on that product, and I'm hopeful that we'll still have an opportunity to before that's finalized. The other is the PCORI evaluation group, and I know that we did see some data from WE and ACT, but we did have the opportunity to provide some you know, input on the initial framework. We had the opportunity to contribute to the development through participation in the PEG, and I recently received an email indicating that the activities of the PEG were going to be transitioning to other entities within PCORI, strategy committees, the methodology committee, and the advisory panels. And just to reiterate that it's an area of great interest to many people in this room, and to make sure that we maintain that feedback loop.
I'd like to thank everyone for inviting me or for working with me on this. I'd like to thank the staff and the chairs for everything that we've done, and I've seen such progress in these last couple of years, and it's really invigorating, and I hope to stay involved at some level with PCORI, and I'll miss all of you, and as I head home, I'll have a lot of thoughts in my mind. Thank you.
Well, and I, once again, I thank you all for spending 2 days with PCORI and sharing your wisdom and your lived experiences and providing direction to PCORI. And I want to remind those of you who are cycling off as members, like Suzanne said, we're going to be reaching out to you because we are going to be developing working groups. We're looking at a lot of new and innovative ways to engage those who already know about PCORI, who believe in our principles. And so we're not saying that this is, you know, you're not rolling off of PCORI, maybe this particular committee, but there are several opportunities that we hope to reach back to you and engage you. So I just want to thank you, you know, personally and professionally. This has been a tremendous opportunity to experience launching the PEEP, and that you're a special membership to have been, you have founded this with all of us together. So in that, I just close with my appreciation, and would like to pass to Charlotte and Darius, and then Jean.
Well, I want to join everyone in thanking those of you who are going to be rotating off right now, you know, Saul, Paul, and Laurel. You've been, you know, a part of us. It's kind of bittersweet that we're having to lose you at this point. One of the things that Sue and, you know, others, and I guess kind of all of us by the end of the first meeting, thought was really important was to look at our role and our activities toward building a community for PEEP. I mean, the other advisory panels at that point when we met that first time had specific activities to do. They had to prioritize topics, and they got that done, and then they could leave. And I think we kind of were wondering, you know, who are we? And we spent the first meeting really trying to process who we are and what we need to do in order to prepare for an important role. And I think that the way Saul articulated it as, you know, becoming the conscience of PCORI is a great way to think about that. And I will take those words forward as we continue on. But we're also looking at how do we integrate and continue to build community as we proceed on with six new faces on this panel the next time we meet. So I hope that you'll get with us, and by us, I mean, it could be me, it could be Darius, but then definitely Sue. I think at some point, really soon, we're going to come together and talk about onboarding, and I appreciate the suggestions from those of you who shared suggestions, like creating a buddy system, creating an orientation packet that has just kind of the baseline glossary of acronyms and all those all the terminology that drives some of us crazy. And as well as other ideas for formal orientation, which we really kind of didn't do when Kim and Amy came on and joined us. But this is a really critical juncture for us as we move forward and how we envision what we will do. We'll build on the level of community we've been able to build heretofore. So with my words of appreciation, not just to those of you who are rotating off, but to everyone who's dedicated so much time, energy, and effort and candor to this process of being a PEEP, thank you.
That's why she's the chair. She said everything I would have said. No, thank you. Thank you to all the members that are rotating off. And all I'll add is we'll see you guys again.
So I really actually can't say anything more eloquent than it's already been said, except that I want to reiterate something that Charlotte said is, you know, you all have self-defined your role, whereas with the other advisory panels, it was defined for them. And so that's actually a lot of work. You know, it really is a lot of work, but it really truly is advisory, if you know what I mean. By defining your role, you've defined the relationship that you have with PCORI, which is a very important thing and something that I value a lot. So, you know, from my perspective, this is, I think, my second or third. I hate the acronym PEEP. So I'm just going to share that, talking about acronyms. But I want to thank all of you. And for those of you that are rotating off, I see you as advisory panel emeritus. I don't think, you know, one ever walks away from an experience of being so heavily involved in an organization, particularly one in its beginning stages. Just a few housekeeping notes. We are working on a post-survey, a post-event survey, so stay tuned. And just to let you know, the spring meeting will be June 1st and 2nd, which is a Monday and Tuesday. And a final personal note is I do have a plumber coming to my house this afternoon. And as one of the more, I want to say, younger staff members said to me, oh, it's like dealing with a car. And I said, no, with cars the expenses are in thousands, and with houses they're in tens of thousands. So pray for me this afternoon. So I wish you all safe travels, and I thank you greatly for your service to PCORI.
And we have a lunch, is that correct, Rachel? Is it a box lunch or is it plate? Pardon? Okay. So help yourself to lunch, and safe travels. And again, a big thank you to Rachel for keeping us organized and on schedule and being our partner in completing the last few days. Thank you. Thanks.